I need to learn to lie better. My grandmother was the Barnum and Bailey of liars. I could hear her head shaking when I told Frederick what I really thought about his grandmother, who had waited 13 lucky years for her gorilla fiancé, his grandfather, while he hid out in the jungle, coming dangerously close to the catastrophe of her own spinsterhood. She must have had some idea what he would have done to her if she hadn't. I still say he ought to have known better, since I had already shown my hand when he told us about his uncle driving backwards through the Amazon for 7 hours, at night. He had just learned, Frederick told us, that my aunt, his fiancée, was ill, and his car was stuck in reverse. But when he got there, it turned out she had nothing more than a head cold. That reminds me of the one about the car trying to back out of the multi-story garage. "There's an exit," the attendant shouted, pointing to the signs. "I know," the car cried back, "but that's not the same thing." If you are facing the ocean, my grand equivocator of a grandmother once said to me. We were on our way to San Francisco together in the early years of her widowhood, and she was contemplating the frozen sea of silent clouds out her window like an aerialist gauging her leap into the arms of the approaching trapezist. The waves can't catch you while you're not looking. But if you don't want to be knocked down by the big waves, I reasoned, you can just step back up onto dry land. Ah, she said, you were always too smart for me. And she squeezed my hand in the way that meant I was her favorite. Sugar. It was the night you were telling me your idea for a movie, the first Yom Kippur after my father died. Lila and I had stayed up late, talking about her mother, the selfless narcissist. That's what my brother calls her, Lila said. Also, the woman who is a cross between an echo and an abyss, an undeveloped character in an abandoned text by Beckett, the thing that cannot stop circling back, which always makes me think of a doubt or a vulture, and the way she picks at the liver of her own sacred litany of lifelong sacrifices, pulling on them like the broken levers of an obstinate machine, pulling them on like a lamentable pair of ancient donkey socks, her cold toes poking through the disappointing threads like the hopeless loophole Thomas's gutsy digits discovered. And after all I've done, as she fumily sputters, winding up in apparent disgust, this is the thanks I get. Lila is a theoretical mathematician when it comes to her mother. Any way you divide her, she likes to say, mother conquers and remains less than the sum of her parts. And yet, no matter how many times she has repacked and fastened her own suitcases for the last time, Lila can't subtract herself from that irrational equation. There was something in this of the way I couldn't seem to shake the image of Jacob Bronowski wading out knee-deep into the muddy river near Auschwitz. It was the way he was standing in it as he scooped up a handful of that trickling mud made with the DNA of his murdered family. That's what had come back to haunt me, the way it spilled back out from between his fingers, the way he seemed to be trying to turn anger into philosophy. Something about it chimed with your story, the sight of your boss weeping at his own announcement of your imminent departure. How it led us to wonder if that was what it was like to be a landowner at the end of serfdom. And together we watched the long line of scarified pans leaping and bouncing silently against the impotent flanks, as the freshly liberated led the last of their shabby mules down the rutted track and into the sunset of the middle class. Well, that was the dream. Every article that week had been fueled by the rage against sugar and the new sex drug, only the latest incarnation of the long line of better things by DuPont. Truly, there was no way around the evidence to indicate that the more we know, the less we are inclined to think about anything. I, for one, in spite of having read my Lucretius, had yet to get the hang of understanding dreams qua dreams, my own or anyone else's, convinced that I could see right through them, all the way into the kitchen, behind the counter, in the big new Levain bakery window. But now, suddenly, at this late hour, it was starting at last to be clearer and clearer that whether it was what we set our sights on or what we were moving steadily and farther every day away from, there was less and less evidence to suggest we would someday get our hands on what was missing. Although there was still hope, there was always hope. Baudrillard's widow. It must have been what Dewey calls the forces. And here's me having always, since I guess the third grade, thought of him as more or less synonymous with decimals and libraries and systems. But, ach du lieber, as my Bavarian grandfather liked to say, if this isn't a different Dewey altogether. The decimals in my eyes were pounding and panting and stinging the way they used to in school. Even after I turned down the lights and lay in my bed and closed the stacks to fall right back into Kafka's labyrinth of ladders and high grids and spines. That grand illusion of order, like Hausmann's Paris. And had I really never noticed the logic and irony of his Teutonic name? This was my paradoxical thought, as I picked my way through blades of dust and light stray chinks flung into gullies through the windowless wilderness, onward, back toward the conversation that had wormed its hungry tunnel all the way to Baudrillard's widow. Her view, to be precise, of what keeps men over 80 happy. But although I've never been sure how this is possible, I seem to be getting ahead of myself. And what I don't want to do, most of all, is leave out the woman we thought we recognized, the tall one with red hair and the beautiful voice from Arkansas, with whom I ended up posing for a photo, as if we were long-lost, serendipitously reunited relations in Balthazar's on a finally summery evening before sitting back down, where the forces, I don't believe there is a better name for them, were systematically at work, within or behind, or maybe underneath the conversation, which, like any conversation, is just a surface, isn't it? Or a lid that can't keep things in or back or down, or out for that matter, and which gets broken, as in by Bonnard's wife's kneecaps, or her chin, in the purples of his vision of her bath, which always looks, to me anyway, like yet another early 20th century watery death, cue the wasteland. They say he was dedicated to her, Bonnard, like a book, maybe, or in his way, and maybe hers, too. After all, hadn't I just the week before sat next to the breathless gentleman from Yorkshire, whose parents had packed him off, along with his twin brother, to the bookish Benedictines at the age of 8. He adored his American wife of very nearly 30 years now, as he hastened to assure me, and I had no cause to doubt his word before he broached the subject of the one thing they'd never seen eye to eye on. That was the day before the day in the pocket bar on 48th, where you and I rolled our eyes at the TA, who assured your Lucy that one thing they could not talk about was Shakespeare's intentions, since we could never know them. Well, I said, if the unknowable is off limits, what next? But you weren't having any. As if she knew her own better than we might, speculating here, in a bar, in a pocket of 48th Street. I suppose it's one thing to be hoist on your own good intentions, you continued, trailing off. And I pointed to the jungle in the Rousseau someone had written the menu over, loosing animals among the decimals. So you will understand how it was that evening that my eyes growled and lowed, even though it was the left, the far-seeing one, more than the right, which is the one I read with. How it must have been from watching the lid tremble and sputter, like an expression of Euler's definition of the gamma function, calculating factorials of the fractions animating the evening's forces. and how, hours later, far from Rousseau's Arkansas, Old Testament riddles, Shakespeare's Paris, Kafka's Yorkshire Terrier, Baudelaire's Swan's Petard, and the mad leaps and dashes of Dewey's Reckless Promises, I closed my aching eyes, like a book whose text had turned to water, to climb into my once familiar dark and marvel at the power of boats over the male octogenarian and the beautiful intelligence it seemed to contain within it.